Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Andrew Roberts. Andrew's a renowned biographer and historian, author most recently of the magisterial Churchill, Walking with Destiny, which came out last year, 2018. And we're talking to Andrew today about his most recent project, just published, Leadership in War, Lessons from Those Who Made History, which has just appeared with Alan Lane. Andrew, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
You are kind, Crawford. Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show.
Well, thank you for your time and sharing your work with us today. Before we start to talk about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, golly. I am 56. I've been writing history books for 30 years. I'm a Englishman, as you could probably hear, but I've got a visiting readership at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and a readership at the New York Historical Society, so I spend quite a lot of time in America, and I'm also a visiting professor at the Department of War Studies here in London, King's College London.
Now, lots of those themes run through the contents of this book, don't they? We have here 10 chapters, including a conclusion, which are miniature biographies, you might say, of very significant historical figures focused very much on this theme of leadership that you want to trace through this cast of characters. As we read across this book, one of the things that strikes me as being very important for many of these individuals is the reading of history. Why was history and the reading of history so important for so many of these people?
Well, you're absolutely right, Crawford. They are all interested, I mean, all without exception, interested in history, and they refer to history, they read history. In Churchill's case, he told a young American student on the time of the coronation, the 1953 coronation, at the coronation luncheon, he said, study history, for therein lies all the secrets of statecraft. And I think lots of these people actually thought that therein lay all the secrets of military leadership, too. And so you see Napoleon, for example, reading a huge amount of books on Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, and then Winston Churchill reading a lot of books on Nelson, but also on Napoleon. He had a small Napoleon library, which you can see at Cambridge University. He himself was his speeches were read and listened to, in fact, by the young Margaret Thatcher. And so you have a sort of apostolic succession, really, going back through history. Adolf Hitler, to use a less positive analogy, was also fascinated by history. He looked at the stories of Arminius and the Emperor Barbarossa and so on. Of course, he named his great offensive against Russia Operation Barbarossa. So again and again, you do see in George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower, both of them read history. Charles de Gaulle was fascinated by history. He had a sort of love-hate relationship with the memory of Napoleon. And so it really is an important aspect to all of these people. And what they learn, I think, is some secrets, some techniques of leadership. They're interested in how far leaders can go. Of course, in Hitler and Napoleon's case, they went too far, especially into Russia. and they didn't learn from history, but other people most certainly did.
Another thing that comes across in a very interesting way through the book is the importance of religious faith for many of these individuals. It's quite striking how often that comes up.
Yes, it is. It is interesting, isn't it? Some were simply not religious at all. Winston Churchill famously described himself as being his relationship to the Church of England as being like a flying buttress, in that he supported it, but from the outside. He believed in an Almighty, but when you look into it theologically, the sole duty of the Almighty seems to have been to look after Winston Churchill. Adolf Hitler had no religious faith of any kind. He believed in a form of providence, but again, providence's job was to make sure that he and the German people prospered. Napoleon, too, had an interesting relationship. Of course, at one point he imprisoned the Pope, which isn't a very sensible thing to do religiously, but you have a sense that he was also the man who ended the French Revolution and therefore allowed the French Catholic Church to live again. Before that, it had just been closed up. Nelson was religious. He deeply believed. Obviously, Stalin wasn't at all, but both Marshall and Eisenhower were God-fearing. It's a it is an interesting thing that runs through the book.
Nelson, you may say he was devout. His lifestyle would not be the typical lifestyle of a devout Christian, would it be?
No, absolutely. Yes, I think. I think there was a good deal of moral hypocrisy there, in that he treated his wife Fanny abysmally, and of course carried on in public with his mistress Lady Hamilton. But nonetheless, he was somebody who made reference to God, who believed in God, and yes. But when one looks at the moral lives of some of these people, it's interesting how some. Like George Marshall and Margaret Thatcher, had strong religious faith and were faithful to their spouses, whereas some people like Napoleon had no fewer than 27 mistresses.
Which leads us interestingly into a discussion about honour, another theme that stretches through the book. Honour is an interesting concept. It seems so out of step with so much contemporary discussion. And yet, for many of your characters, it really matters. Why is that? What do they understand by honour, and what does honour mean to them?
Well, for most of them, if not all of them, they had a sense of personal honour, not necessarily one that... drove them, but they also had a sense of national honour, which was important, which was something that they didn't feel that they could stand by and see traduced. The classic example, of course, being Charles de Gaulle, who really saved the honour of France when he fled France in June 1940 and came here to London to set up the Free French and continue the struggle against the Nazis. He had a very powerful sense of public honour. So also did Churchill in his great speech again in 1940 at the time of the death of Neville Chamberlain. He speaks about the ranks of honour and who marches in them and who doesn't, and how important it is to keep faith with your conscience in order to continue to, as he says, march in the ranks of honour. So, yes, it is an important thing. Napoleon felt that his personal honour was being traduced in 1814 when the Allies were offering peace deals, and indeed 1813, which clashed with his concept of the coronation oath that he had taken in 1804. So, yes, it is an important and interesting aspect of all of these people, really.
It's an interesting theme because it's situated somewhere between self-respect, individual and national self-respect, and pride.
Yes, I think you get this very much also, of course, with Margaret Thatcher at the time of the Falklands crisis. Whereas there were people who were saying, look, we could have a condominium organisation with the Argentinians where they have the sovereignty, but they lease back the islands and so on. For Margaret Thatcher, it went far deeper than that, and it went to concepts of honour and whether or not the promises made over the years to the islanders by the British Crown were going to be upheld or whether they weren't.
Hmm. Well, in the book we have nine miniature biographies. How did you choose on these nine individuals, Andrew?
With complete serendipity, I have to admit. I don't for a moment pretend that these are the most nine most important leaders in history. There are plenty of people who I didn't speak about. The genesis of this project was that I was asked to give a speech on anything I wanted to do with military history to the New York Historical Society over 3 years. And so I decided deliberately not to to give lectures on Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, or George Washington, because I didn't really feel that I could teach the Americans terribly much about their own great national heroes. But it was a it was just decision on my part to speak about people who interested me and who I had written about and who I think thought I had something interesting and new to say about. So please don't ask me why isn't Bismarck there, as somebody did at a bookshop yesterday.
That was my next question.
Just simply because I don't consider that I know enough about Bismarck to write about him.
Well, let's start with Napoleon. What are the lessons in leadership, as your book title puts it, from Napoleon?
Just so many. Just so many. He was, in many ways, the exemplar of the concept of leadership, even though, of course, he lost. This is an interesting thing about Napoleon, that he was ultimately, of course, defeated and died in exile, and so you would naturally think of him as a loser. However, he was the exemplar of almost all of the great sort of secrets of leadership, the way in which he gave out glory, distinction, and rewards, the way in which he created a meritocracy amongst his marshals, the creation of the Legion d'Honneur, the way in which he allowed access to himself. He'd always make sure, for example, whenever they bivouacked, that the sentries got the wine first and the drummer boys were allowed to sit around the campfire. This wonderful sort of sense of access to him, which was very unusual in those days. You certainly didn't get it in the British Army. His orders of the day, the way in which he would personally give standards to people. Sometimes in battle, he would take off his own Legion d'Honneur and give it to somebody who he'd seen do something brave. And this is all tremendous sense of leadership, his timing, his compartmentalization of his mind, so he was able to think about one thing, whatever was going on around him. There's a whole list in the at the end of my chapter, my essay on Napoleon, which explains his extraordinary capacity for the leadership of men. He said, one must speak to the soul. It's the only way to electrify the men.
Hmm. And you twin Napoleon with Nelson in the following chapter. How does Nelson compare?
Well, it's a different kind of leadership, of course. He's not a national leader, and actually warfare on land is hugely different from warfare at sea. And warfare at sea was, at least the kind that Nelson attempted to prosecute, was a war of sheer annihilation. He always wanted to go for annihilation. He was tremendously aggressive, fearless. He was a predator. And he believed in keeping the initiative as much as possible. He didn't mind disobeying orders, so long as, of course, he was successful. Everybody let him do that. He had this burning hatred of the French Revolution, which is why, as you say, they're twins, because, of course, Napoleon wanted to bring the French Revolution to an end, but to an end in which he extended its premises across Europe, and Nelson was very much opposed to that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And then chapters 3 and 4 give us another set of twins, I suppose, Churchill and Hitler. Churchill, obviously, the subject of your last magisterial work. How did you approach Churchill differently in writing this particular chapter?
Well, what I tried to do was to concentrate on this extraordinary sense how in 1940 and 1941, he kept putting forward ideas for how we were going to win the war, at least be on the winning side of the war, even though it didn't seem until June 1941, at least when Hitler invaded Russia, that we could possibly be on the winning side. The French had been knocked out in 6 weeks of campaigning. We'd been flung off the continent at Dunkirk. The Russians were on the side of the Germans. The Americans were totally uninterested in getting in the war. So how on earth, why on earth should we continue to prosecute this war that it didn't look like we could win, and which Lord Halifax's foreign secretary was saying, actually, we shouldn't continue to prosecute anyway, and we should come to some kind of terms with Hitler. And Churchill came up with these various ideas that Germany would be destabilized by bad harvests, was one of them, that we'd be able to blockade Germany, i.e. the entirety of Europe. He said that the Americans were going to join, which was very unlikely. He said the French were going to counterattack towards the early part of June 1940, which was even more unlikely. And so my sense of his leadership at that time, in persuading the British people that without really any good arguments that we hadn't lost the war, was in itself one of the greatest acts of leadership that he undertook. Because if we had got done a peace with Hitler in 1940, it would have ultimately been extremely disastrous for us. So this, in a sense, what you needed at a time of such national peril was somebody who was illogical and irrational and romantic, a romantic figure like Churchill, who was able to persuade the British people with his eloquence what, to all intents and purposes, any rational or logical person would have believed to be impossible.
And yet, for all of his extraordinary public persona and success, one of the things that was really striking about your chapter is your note that he only became financially solvent when he was 73 years old.
Yes, that's right, which is a very good thing. And he was financially solvent when he was 73 because he had signed the contract for his war memoirs. And so that was very good for him. But and the first thing he did, of course, was the classic sort of Regency aristocratic thing, which was to buy the first of 37 racehorses. But the good thing for us, at least certainly for biographers of Churchill and people who write about him, is that he was forced, because he was broke all the time, to write his 37 books and over 800 articles. And it's through them that we can, you know, get into the mind of the man.
Now, we follow the chapter on Churchill with a chapter on Adolf Hitler, and you begin that chapter with the following observation. Any understanding of Adolf Hitler has to begin by acknowledging the fact that he was extravagantly admired and even worshipped by millions of normal people for more than a decade. That's leadership, isn't it?
It's a form of it. It is, but it's also a completely artificial form of charisma. Charisma in my... I started the lecture series thinking that charisma was a good thing and an actually, you know, positive thing. But actually, it's morally neutral. It's like nuclear fission. It can be used for good and for ill. And Hitler had it. But the only reason he had it was that he had, through Joseph Goebbels, controlled the news agenda, the media, for 12 years. So he had this power that was not given to Democrats of not being criticized. He also, of course, had Leni Riefenstahl doing his films and Albert Speer doing his rallies. And frankly, with that, you could make any person charismatic, even somebody as physically unprepossessing as Hitler. But what did also come out, I hope you agree, from that chapter was his extreme personal weirdness when it came to his beliefs. I don't mean just his hateful, anti-Semitic and racial beliefs, but also beliefs about all sorts of things that had nothing to do with politics.
Science fiction, etc. Did you find it difficult to write about Hitler with a view of thinking about learning lessons in leadership from his style?
Yes, of course, and it is controversial, and I do get criticised. You know, how can you possibly say that Hitler was a great leader? Now, and that all hinges, of course, on the word "great," because I'm not saying he was a great leader, as in that he was an admirable leader. Clearly not, but he was a substantial leader. He did lead the world into war in the middle of the 20th century, which is obviously something that is enormous and thus great in the sense of being large. He was very successful in the beginning. When one thinks in 1939 to the 21st of June 1941, he knocked out Poland in 4 weeks, knocked out France in 6, knocked out Yugoslavia and Greece in 3. I mean, these are extraordinary achievements of Blitzkrieg, and indeed at the very opening stages of Operation Barbarossa, it was incredibly successful. So I think just because he lost the war in the way that Napoleon also lost the war shouldn't blind us to the fact that he did have some leadership techniques, some secrets of leadership that it's worth examining in a book like this.
You mentioned Barbarossa, Andrew, and of course the next chapter takes us to Joseph Stalin, another of these monsters. You begin that chapter with... The famous quotation of the revolution devouring its children. How do we see this happening through Stalin?
Well, he massacred the Red Army between 1936 and 1938, at least the leadership of the Red Army. If you were a general or a colonel or a marshal of the Red Army in those years, you had a 1 in 3 chance of being purged, being shot. And so... He went through this the high command in a completely paranoid way, because they weren't plotting to overthrow the Bolshevik Party and to assassinate or imprison him. They just simply weren't. But nonetheless, he felt that out of in his sort of paranoid sense that they were, and this meant, of course, that 3 years later, when the Second World War, when Hitler invaded, they had a pretty substandard officer corps. They had to bring people out of the prisons and put them straight into high command in order to defend against this sudden surprise attack by the Germans. There's one moment where Marshal Rokossovsky, one of the top Russian generals, actually comes into Hitler's presence, and he's had all his teeth knocked out by the NKVD down in the Lubyanka prison, and Stalin looks at him and says, "Where have you been?" He knows perfectly well where Rokossovsky had been for the previous few years.
And yet he becomes Time magazine Man of the Year for 1939 and 42.
I know, it's extraordinary really, but nonetheless, when one thinks of the 27 million Russians who died in the Second World War, pretty much any other leader, apart from somebody as ruthless as Stalin, would not have been able to have kept that country in the war. And one has to remember that for every five Germans killed in conflict in the Second World War, four of them die on the Eastern Front.
Yes, you mentioned the attrition rate there. Is it something like 80%, you say?
Yeah, four out of five, which is a completely extraordinary number, and it just puts into perspective really what the British, Americans, Canadians, and what the rest of us were doing on the Western Front, really.
You mentioned the Americans, and we have two chapters here, one in Marshall, one in Eisenhower. If you take those two characters together, how do you see them relate? How do you see them develop distinctive leadership styles, but working effectively side by side to lead the Americans?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, not exactly side by side, because, of course, Eisenhower always did look up to George Marshall, and he was protege of George Marshall. And so he was learning all the time from George Marshall. But Marshall managed to get the American army from 200,000 men when the war broke out in September 1939, up to 60 million Americans in uniform at the time that it ended in the Japanese surrendered in September 1946. The most extraordinary increase, some by 80 times. Is quite something, and he managed to organise it all, and I think that in itself was a justification for putting him in this chapter. With regard to, and he had lots of sort of leadership traits. One was never to appear tired. He remembered how General Pershing used to sometimes appear tired, and it was very bad for morale. And so, however tired he was, he propped his eyes open and kept going, you know, pinching himself to make sure that he didn't appear tired in front of the staff. With Eisenhower, of course, he was a Supreme Allied Commander leading a coalition. He was a sort of chairman of the board. And you see his energy and his decency and his good sense and his calmness, I hope, in this chapter. And when one considers the sheer extraordinary number of people he was ordering around, 91 divisions, including 28,000 planes, nearly a million vehicles. You can so understand why he had stage 2 hypertension. He was smoking 4 packets of cigarettes a day. He had a blood pressure of 176 over 110. It was just about as stressful a job as possible, and yet he too went out of his way always to appear calm.
The Second World War is really at the heart of this book, isn't it? We have Churchill, Hitler, Stalin, Marshall, de Gaulle, who was mentioned briefly already, and Eisenhower. Taking the view from 2019 and looking at the way in which each of those leaders positioned their nations to come out of the war with their very different experiences, which of them would you say won the war?
That's a very good question. Well, actually, somebody who isn't in the book, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was the person who had the overall plan of when to attack in the West, and he joined with Field Marshal Sir Alan Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, the chairman of the British chiefs of staff, and Churchill to stop George Marshall from going into northwestern France any earlier than D-Day. Marshall was originally wanting to do it as early as the autumn of 1942, which, as I say in my essay, I think would have been disastrous because we didn't have air support and we hadn't won the Battle of the Atlantic. But the person who then changed sides in the Washington Conference in June 1943 and insisted on D-Day taking place in the summer of 1944 was FDR, which does crop up, of course, in the book, but I haven't dedicated an entire chapter to him.
Now, the last chapter is a chapter you dedicate to the most remarkable English woman since Queen Elizabeth I, as you put it, and your focus there is on Margaret Thatcher's response to the Falkland Islands crisis. Why did you choose...
It's sort of very untypical that she should have not organised some kind of a back down of a negotiation. Most normal people, politicians, certainly I think male politicians would have come to some kind of agreement with Argentina over this in 1982, but she had a, as we mentioned earlier, a sense of honour, also this Churchillian spirit to her, and a sort of bloody-mindedness that she wasn't going to be pushed around by the Argentinian junta. And so she basically ripped up in 1982 all of the post-Suez assumptions that were made by Whitehall and Westminster and the Foreign Office.
Now, which of these individuals that you've written about do you most admire?
Well, having just done this big biography of Churchill Walking with Destiny, I suppose it has to be him ultimately. It was just so much fun to write that book. You never have to go more than about three pages without coming across a Churchill joke or some aperçu or some wonderfully quoted witticism or so on. So I suppose in terms of that, who the best leader was, however, I think is a different question, if you don't mind me asking myself a question you haven't asked, is Napoleon, for the reasons that, as I say, I give at the end of the Napoleon chapter. He just had pretty much every single attribute that a great leader needs to have, and which most of the others in the book, except for Adolf Hitler, tended to have to a degree. But Napoleon had all of them. But of course, as we mentioned earlier, ultimately he lost.
Well, Andrew, we've taken up a lot of your time today. But before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment, what your next book might be?
Yes, I'm writing somebody who wouldn't actually appear in a book about great leadership in war, and who also lost, and that's King George III. He was not the tyrant of the Declaration of Independence, let alone the villain of Hamilton the musical. He was, in fact, a Renaissance figure. He was an enlightened monarch. He was just very unfortunate to live in the same decade as such geniuses as Washington and Franklin and Adams and Madison and Munro and Hamilton himself and all the rest of them. That was his tragedy.
Well, that sounds like a great project, and hopefully we can get to chat about that in due course too. For now, thanks very much for your time, and thanks for coming on to the show to talk about it, and take care.
I really enjoyed it, Crawford. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.